content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from one of our double issues this week, one that typically comes out around the July 4th holiday. This is the July 13th, 2018 edition of the Week magazine. And we will mix and match over the next two shows and get two shows out of it. So today we are looking at the cover drawing. And it shows in the foreground Sarah Huckabee Sanders. She's looking, holding an empty plate, and she has a slightly more disgruntled look than usual. There's an empty place setting in front of her, and in the background there's a woman turned the other direction. She's looks like somebody that would work at the restaurant. She's got an apron and she's got her arms folded and looking the other direction. The title is Shunning Sarah. Is the left justified in treating Trump aides like pariahs? And I think that one shows up on the controversy of the week, but we'll start as usual with the main stories and how they were covered. The chaotic effort to reunite migrant families. What happened? The Trump administration struggled this week to reunite thousands of children separated from their parents at the border after officials conceded they had no coordinated system between federal agencies to track and return children scattered around the country in government shelters and foster homes. Citing a chaotic circumstance of the government's own making, a federal judge in California ordered children under five to be returned to their parents within 14 days, and children over five returned in 30 days or fewer. Approximately 500 children recently held at CBP facilities have been reunited with their parents, but Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said Tuesday his agency still held 2,047 children, only six fewer than in HHS custody a week ago, and that most could not be reunited with their parents who are still in custody. The Texas Civil Rights Project, which represents over 300 parents but has located only two separated children, said bureaucratic errors have stymied their efforts. One legal aid lawyer in Texas said, "You wait and wait for no information." President Trump doubled down on his anti-immigrant rhetoric, tweeting that Democrats want illegal immigrants to pour into and infest our country, and that immigrants who show up at the U.S. border should be immediately deported without due process. At an event where family members of people killed by undocumented immigrants held large photos of the deceased, autographed by the president, Trump again warned that criminals were coming across the border and lamented the lack of media coverage for citizens permanently separated from their loved ones. A second Republican immigration bill went down in flames in Congress this week, losing 121 to 301. The bill, backed by GOP leaders, was an attempt at compromise between the party's moderates and immigration hawks, and would have provided a path for citizenship to recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the DACA program, and $25 billion for border security, including Trump's wall. The president had sent mixed messages about the bill, first saying they should stop wasting their time on immigration before the midterms, then reversing course and calling for the passage of a strong but fair bill to show that Dems won't open borders equals crime. What the editorial said: Clearly, the administration devoted little thought or effort to reunifying families, said the Washington Post. That's hardly a surprise, given the president's callous assertion that Democrats are telling phony stories of sadness and grief. Attorney General Jeff Sessions explicitly said that breaking up families was meant to serve as a deterrent. And with the president and top aides providing no transparency or leadership on this issue, the chaos and anguish are unlikely to end soon. Trump deserves credit for reversing course, said the Chicago Tribune. But when he reversed the family separation policy last week, he failed to seize the moment and rally Congress for legislation that would end family separation, strengthen border security, and address the fate of the Dreamers. While blaming everyone else, Trump did nothing to fix our dysfunctional system. Only Congress can fix our insane immigration regime, said National Review. Right now, the system starkly pits humanitarian concerns against enforcement. We need legislation to authorize the detention of children for longer than the 20 days mandated by the Flores Decree, a well-intentioned anti-trafficking law that should be amended to make it easier to deport minors, and more money should be allocated for family space and the hiring of hundreds of judges to expedite the asylum process. What the columnist said. Trump proclaimed his compassion in signing the executive order undoing his own directive, said Alex Wagner in TheAtlantic.com. But his feigned concern didn't last long. He quickly switched to warning that the U.S. will be overrun by people, by crime, by all of these things we don't stand for. Under Trump, the Republican Party has been defined around white nationalism, which deems brown-skinned people vermin who want to infest our country, and mocks the wailing screams of innocence. Trump claims to want comprehensive immigration reform, but he torpedoed the House Republican bills by tweet, said Amber Phillips in WashingtonPost.com. He actually prefers to ratchet up the anti-immigrant sentiment that brings roars of delight from his base. Republicans do not need to devote billions of dollars to incarcerating immigrants and building a border wall, said James Gibney in Bloomberg.com. Border apprehensions in 2017 were less than one-fifth of what they were in 2000. To further cut down on illegal immigration, Congress could simply impose a nationwide e-verify system to discourage border crossers looking to work in the U.S. Thanks to Trump's dehumanizing words, liberals think that resisting immigration enforcement is the civil rights struggle of our time, said W. James Antle III in TheWeek.com. Many on the left want to abolish ICE and abandon even nominal commitment to immigration enforcement. But unregulated immigration comes with economic costs and produces cultural backlashes. Americans should not have to choose between the exaggerated fears of immigration promoted by Trump and the happy talk of Democrats that ignores inconvenient truths. And we'll read a second main story today. The Supreme Court okays Trump's travel ban. What happened? The Supreme Court this week upheld President Trump's travel ban on citizens from several Muslim-majority countries, delivering a victory to the White House in its first major ruling on a Trump administration policy. The court voted 5-4 in Trump versus Hawaii, with conservative justices in the majority, rejecting arguments that Trump's executive order exceeded his lawful powers and violated constitutional protections against religious discrimination. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that Trump has ample authority to restrict the entry of certain non-citizens on national security grounds. Roberts also rebuffed the contention that Trump's past comments, including his call during the presidential campaign for a total and complete shutdown on Muslims entering the U.S., proved that the order was motivated by religious bias. "The text says nothing about religion," Roberts wrote. The day after the ruling was issued, Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement. The White House hailed the court's decision as a profound vindication of its immigration policies. In a blistering dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor likened the decision to the Supreme Court's infamous 1944 ruling in Korematsu versus the United States, which upheld the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Quoting President Trump's own comments, including his assertion that Islam hates us, Sotomayor argued that a reasonable observer would see the order as driven by the president's hostility to Muslims. "History will not look kindly on the court's decision," she said, "nor should it." What the editorial said: "The ruling proves that our system of checks and balances works," says the Wall Street Journal. "Trump's first two travel bans were ill-conceived, and lower courts struck them down. But the version that the Supreme Court approved was the result of a careful review of countries' security risks by the administration. The anti-Trump resistance still caricatures the policy as a Muslim ban, but judges must rule on actual policy, not a candidate's campaign statements. The conservative justices have a double standard on religion," said the New York Times. It was just a few weeks ago that the same justices ruled in favor of a Christian baker who had refused to bake a cake for a gay couple's wedding. In that instance, they claimed a Colorado civil rights commissioner had violated the baker's First Amendment rights by expressing bias against his religious beliefs. The principle didn't carry over to this case when the official was the president and the target of his remarks was not a single shopkeeper, but millions of Muslims around the world. What the columnist said: "The Supreme Court has given Trump a green light to discriminate," said Adam Serwer in TheAtlantic.com. Roberts argued that because Trump's order doesn't explicitly mention religion, it can't be motivated by hostility toward Muslims. By that logic, racist Jim Crow-era laws like the literacy test that disenfranchised many black voters would have been entirely constitutional because they could have potentially targeted whites, too. Trump is now free to implement any prejudiced policy he wants, so long as his advisors launder the president's bigotries through facially neutral language. "The only surprising thing is that four justices against the Trump administration," said David French in NationalReview.com, "ruled against the administration. The court's job is to follow the law as it's written, not save the country from Trump. Congress has delegated vast immigration powers to the executive branch over the years. If the American people don't want the president to exercise a breathtaking degree of control over American immigration policy, then Congress must act." Democrats could have stopped this ruling, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. "They stayed home in record numbers in the 2014 midterms, costing them the Senate majority and the chance to fill the Supreme Court seat that opened up after Justice Antonin Scalia's death. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked President Obama's nominee until Trump's election when he gifted it to Neil Gorsuch, cementing the court's conservative majority. Now Kennedy's retirement has given Trump an opportunity to appoint a second justice and entrench conservative rule on the court for a generation. Liberals contemplating that possibility with horror should take away a simple lesson. Every election matters." And before we leave this page, we'll read one of the It Wasn't All Bad shorter pieces. In the run-up to her 107th birthday, Mida Lewis was asked by her hospice nurse if there was anything she'd ever dreamed of doing. The Oklahoma replied that she'd always wanted to ride in a convertible like she was in a parade. Word soon spread about the birthday wish, and on the centenarian's big day, hundreds of confetti-throwing residents of her hometown of Stillwater turned out to cheer on Lewis as she was driven down Main Street in a silver convertible while wearing a sparkly tiara, pink sunglasses, and a diamante-studded sash. The show of community spirit, said resident Carmen Steele, just shows what Stillwater, is made of. Controversy of the week refers back to the drawing on the cover. The title is Politics, Liberal Anger, and the New Incivility. Whatever happened to when they go low, we go high? Asked Melissa Brownstein in TheFederalist.com. Michelle Obama's oft-repeated maxim sounded nice, but since Donald Trump moved into the White House, partisan debate has become coarser, cruder, more disheartening, and inflammatory than ever. But last week, the left reached a new low point for civility with the harassment of White House staffers in restaurants. First, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and Trump advisor Stephen Miller were hounded out of different Mexican restaurants by protesters furious over the family separation policy. Then the owner of the Red Hen restaurant in Virginia refused to serve White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders and asked her to leave the premises because of a moral objection to Trump administration policies on immigration and LGBT issues. This is outright discrimination of the kind liberals claim to oppose, said WashingtonExaminer.com in an editorial. But most on the left applauded these acts of bigotry, with Democratic Representative Maxine Waters even calling for mobs to harass Trump cabinet officials in all public spaces and tell them they're not welcome anymore anywhere. In the revved-up left's new incivility, you are your politics. The hypocrisy here is all on the right, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. If Christian bakers can refuse to bake cakes for same-sex weddings because they're disgusted at the thought of gay people getting married, why can't restaurateurs deny their delightful creations to people who work for an authoritarian, racist presidency? There is something surreal about being lectured on civility by the party of Donald Trump, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Trump built his political brand with a racist crusade built on the lie that President Obama was born in Africa. He encouraged his supporters to commit acts of violence against protesters at his rallies. He now spends days tweeting nasty, puerile jibes at Democrats, athletes, and celebrities who displease him. Yet Sarah Sanders gets politely asked to leave one restaurant, and suddenly it's liberals who are plumbing the depths of incivility. You have got to be kidding me. We're not living through a crisis of manners, said Michelle Goldberg in NYTimes.com. We're living through a crisis of democracy. The self-appointed civility police should remember that the current occupant of the Oval Office, installed with the help of a hostile foreign power, is using his presidency to demonize immigrants, sabotage the U.S. healthcare system, alienate our allies overseas, and pander to his supporters' deep well of resentment. Figures like Nielsen, Miller, and Sanders are actively abetting this dangerous, degrading presidency, and fully deserve the sort of public opprobrium do members of any other white nationalist organization? Truly, these are terrifying times for America, said Charles Pearson, Esquire.com. If you're being civil, you're not paying attention. What liberals don't understand, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, is that their contempt for Trump supporters might end up reelecting him. In 2016, Trump won the votes of 63 million Americans sick of being sneered at and marginalized by the left. Heading into the next election, do liberals really want to hand him the campaign message, "Now you're so deplorable, they won't serve you in their restaurants"? Trump's election, unfortunately, has opened a Pandora's box of righteous partisan rage, said Jonathan Last in WeeklyStandard.com. Let's hope our national institutions prove strong enough to stop incivility from escalating into violence. But right now, it looks like this business will get out of control. Time for our good week, bad week segment. Looks like it was a good week for work-life balance. After the mayor of Warren, Michigan, advised constituents that he is not obligated to stop and talk to them about their problems when he's out running. Mayor Jim Fouts, 70, said he's available 24/7, but not when I'm jogging. It was a good week for changing your luck. After Alex Bregman of the Houston Astros shaved off his mustache between innings of a game against the Kansas City Royals, apparently in hopes it would break his batting slump. "I just shaved it," Bergman told baffled sports writers. And it was a good week for hippies, with the announcement by archaeologists that after a five-day excavation of a field in upstate New York, they are close to pinpointing the exact location of the stage at 1969's Woodstock Music Festival. "It's some science, it's some guesswork," said archaeologist Paul Brown. "You hope that you get lucky." But it was a bad week for wasting money when bank workers in Tinsukia, India, discovered a dead rat inside an ATM machine, next to the chewed and shredded remains of an estimated $19,000 in rupees. It was a bad week for fan appreciation after the Philly Fanatic, the mascot of the Philadelphia Phillies, shot a Frankfurter into the stands at a game last week, striking fan Kathy McVeigh in the face and giving her a black eye. "At least it's funny," McVeigh said. And it was a bad week for New England, with the detection of a possible new supervolcano being created by upwelling lava beneath Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire. "There is no immediate need to panic, however," said Rutgers University professor Vadim Levin. "Come back in 50 million years, and we'll see what happens." And before we leave this page, we'll do the boring but important short piece they have here. GOP tax law hits churches, nonprofits. Tax-exempt organizations such as churches, synagogues, and hospitals may now be required to pay taxes on some employee benefits, to the apparent surprise of many GOP lawmakers who voted for the change in last year's tax code overhaul. The new law imposes a 21% tax on perks such as travel reimbursements, parking, and meals. Tax experts say the changes could force thousands of groups to begin filing returns and paying taxes for the first time. More than 600 churches and nonprofits have signed a petition demanding the tax be repealed. "We're talking about an income tax on the church for providing parking to its employees," said Mike Batts of the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. It's absurd. We're going to read a few pieces from a section called The U.S. at a Glance. First from New York City, primary upset. Representative Joseph Crowley, the number four Democrat in the House, suffered a stunning primary defeat this week to a political newcomer, 28-year-old activist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The blowout loss for Crowley, who's held his seat since 1999 and was on the short list to replace Nancy Pelosi as Democratic leader, sent shockwaves through a party looking to retake the House in November. Ocasio-Cortez, a former organizer for Bernie Sanders and a member of the Democratic Socialist of America, ran an unapologetically progressive campaign. Despite being dramatically outspent, she campaigned aggressively in her solid blue minority-majority district, which included parts of Queens and the Bronx, advocating Medicare for all, free public college education, gun control, and an end to corporate money in politics. She spent the last few days before the primary in Texas at the U.S.-Mexico border, calling for the abolition of immigration and customs enforcement. Her victory is considered the biggest Democratic primary upset in at least a decade. From Peoria, Arizona, pharmacy dispute. Walgreens faced angry calls for a boycott this week after an Arizona pharmacist refused to fill a prescription for medication that would induce a miscarriage for a woman with an unviable pregnancy. Nicole Arteaga had been saddened to learn from her doctor that her nine-week-old fetus heart had stopped beating. She opted to take misoprostol, a medication used to end a failed pregnancy. But the pharmacist at the local Walgreens refused to fill the order on ethical grounds, ignoring Arteaga's tearful and careful pleas while her seven-year-old son was in earshot. What the pharmacist failed to understand is that something I have zero control over, said Arteaga, 35, in a Facebook post. She later obtained the medication at another Walgreens. Refusing to fill prescriptions is expressly permitted under Arizona law and Walgreens policy. This is from Augusta, Georgia. Leak guilty plea. Reality winner, a 26-year-old decorated former Air Force linguist, pleaded guilty in a federal court in Georgia this week to leaking a top-secret National Security Agency report about Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Winner, whose plea argument calls for her to serve 63 months in prison, was the first person prosecuted by the Trump administration for leaking classified information. She has spent the past year in jail without bond contesting the government's case. Winner stood accused of leaking an NSA report on cyber attacks by the Russian military against more than 100 American election officials, as well as against a voting software company. The report was published by the news site The Intercept, and clues on the printout led government investigators to Winner, who is charged under the Espionage Act, a World War I era law aimed at spies. Washington, D.C. Kennedy to retire. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who often served as the decisive swing vote in 5-4 decisions, announced his retirement from the Supreme Court this week, giving President Trump a chance to entrench the court's conservative majority for decades. The vacancy is sure to precipitate a furious political showdown, with Republicans eager to decisively shift the direction of the court and reverse some of its most contentious decisions on issues such as abortion, gun rights, and affirmative action. Kennedy, 81, was nominated by Ronald Reagan in 1988 and proved to be a moderately conservative justice, casting decisive votes in cases that loosened campaign finance restrictions and upheld individual gun rights. But he also sided with the court's liberal bloc in numerous landmark decisions, including those that limited the death penalty and defended the right to abortion. He also wrote the 2015 majority opinion in Obergefell versus Hodges, which established the constitutional right for gay people to marry. And now the world at a glance. First, we're in Ocampo, Mexico. All police arrested. Michoacán State Police arrested the entire 28-strong police force of Ocampo this week in connection with the murder of a candidate running to be the city's mayor. A day earlier, state authorities had tried to detain and question Ocampo's top police official, Oscar Gonzalez Garcia, about the killing of Fernando Angeles Juarez, who was aligned with the leftist Democratic Revolution Party. But the city police stepped in to block the arrest and fired their guns in the air, leading state authorities to retreat. Since campaigning began last September for the July 1st municipal, presidential, and legislative elections, at least 130 candidates, politicians, and public servants have been killed, compared with 9 deaths in the run-up to the 2012 elections. This is from Algiers, Algeria. Starving in the desert. Algeria has expelled some 13,000 migrants into the Sahara Desert over the past year, forcing them to walk across the scorching desert without food or water. Activists said the migrants are crammed into trucks, driven south into the desert, and ordered to trek in temperatures of up to 118 degrees, sometimes at gunpoint, to neighboring Mali or Niger. Hundreds are believed to have died en route. The mass expulsions began in 2017 when the European Union began pressuring North Africa nations to stop migrants from sub-Saharan Africa from reaching the Mediterranean and heading to Europe. "It's a catastrophe," said Al-Hussein Adewale of the International Organization for Migration, who tries to help the migrants when they arrive at Niger's borders. From Brasilia, migrants stay home. Vice President Mike Pence this week told Central Americans thinking of immigrating to the U.S. that if they can't come legally, don't come at all. Pence made the comments in Brasilia during the first stop of a Latin American tour, which will see him discuss the crisis at the southern U.S. border with leaders from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. "To all the nations of the region," Pence said in a meeting with Brazilian President Michael Temer, "let me say with great respect that just as the United States respects your borders and your sovereignty, we insist that you respect ours." The two men also spoke about Venezuela, where a collapsing economy has caused millions of Venezuelans to flee to Colombia, Brazil, and other nations. Pence said the U.S. would provide an extra $10 million to support Venezuelan migrants. This is from Sotobanari, Japan. Naked hermit evicted. An 82-year-old Japanese man who had been living alone and naked on a remote island near Taiwan for the past 30 years has been brought back to civilization over worries about his health. Masafumi Nagasaki has lived on Sotobanari since 1989, receiving rice cakes and water once a week from nearby islanders. He came to the world's attention in 2012 when he gave a rare interview in which he said his only wish was to die on the island, surrounded by nature. But a few months ago, a visitor to the island called the police, saying Nagasaki looked unwell, and Japanese authorities have now put him in government housing on the nearby island of Ishigaki. They won't allow him to return, said Alvaro Cerezo, a filmmaker who once spent 5 days with the hermit. This is from Davao, Philippines. Duarte versus God. Filipino Catholics, who make up 80% of the country's population, were startled this week when President Rodrigo Duarte launched a surprise attack on a new target, God. At a speech in Davao, Duarte said, "Who is this stupid God? This son of a bitch is really stupid to have allowed Adam and Eve to fall from Eden." Relations between president and church were already strained. Catholic officials had protested Duterte's shoot-to-kill policy towards suspected drug dealers and have offered protection to police who testify about extrajudicial killings. Duterte, who says he was molested by a priest as a teenager, likes to hand out copies of a book exposing corruption and sex abuse in the Philippine Catholic Church. From Riyadh, women drivers. Saudi women began driving legally this week as Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's latest reform came into effect. Some women jumped behind the wheel at midnight, saying they had waited decades for the moment. "I am between belief and disbelief, between a feeling of joy and astonishment," said new driver Makrabuta Al-Mari. Most Saudi women, though, have yet to obtain licenses, and wait lists for gender-segregated driving classes are long. The most prominent activist who campaigned for the right can't hit the road. Lujan al-Hathloul, Aziza al-Yusuf, Iman al-Nafjan, and eight others were detained a month before the ban was lifted, apparently as a warning that women's rights will be decided by the monarchy, not by the activists. It's time for a few of the best columns of the week. The first one we'll read comes from the U.S. called "The Perils of High-Tech Policing." Breakthroughs in policing technology are slowly chiseling away at our civil rights and liberty, said Barry Friedman. The Supreme Court took a small step to halt that erosion last week, ruling that before the government can seize more than 6 days of your cell phone location history, it must have probable cause to show you did something wrong, and a warrant. Yet this narrow judgment should give you little comfort. The use of surveillance and tracking technology by law enforcement agencies is expanding at a head-spinning speed, and the courts can't keep up with the pace of change. Drones will soon follow us from the sky. Facial recognition technology will watch us on the ground. Algorithms will pinpoint where crimes will supposedly occur next. This technology has promise. Drones could help locate missing children, for example. But it could also do unfathomable damage. Privacy rights will wither if we can't escape the government's watchful gaze. And because so much street policing in recent years has focused on minority communities, think stop and frisk, algorithms that factor in past offenses will inevitably send officers to places again and again. Lawmakers urgently need to regulate this brave new world of policing because the technology is getting away from us fast. This is a How They See Us column. Giving up on human rights. the U.S. has added another withdrawal to its long list of international disengagements, said Marie Bourou and Giles Paris in Le Monde from France, citing the supposed anti-Israel bias of the United Nations Human Rights Council. The Trump administration last week declared it was quitting the 47-nation body. In announcing the pullout, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, could not find enough harsh words for the 12-year-old council. She called it hypocritical and a cesspool of bias, noting that the organization had passed 5 resolutions against Israel so far this year, more than the number passed against North Korea, Iran, and Syria combined. Of course, hypocrisy is in the eye of the beholder. Haley pointed out that the council's member nations include serial human rights offenders such as Congo and Venezuela, but was careful to avoid mentioning Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates, U.S. allies that are bombing and starving innocent civilians in Yemen. America's exit was long overdue, said Julie Linares in the Jerusalem Post. Human rights abuses abound around the world, but this council singles out only Israel for special condemnation. Of the 135 resolutions it adopted from 2006 to 2016 that criticized countries, 68, more than 50%, targeted the only Jewish state in the world and the only true democracy in the Middle East. The council's agenda item 7 actually mandates a discussion of the implications of the Israeli occupation of Palestine every time the body meets. This morally bankrupt organization exists to let the worst criminal regimes wash their hands of responsibility while simultaneously entertaining the absurd obsession with the Jewish state. It's true that the council is a farce, said Damir Frass in Mitteldeutsche Zeitung from Germany. Some of its members are hideous human rights abusers. Qatar is practically a slave state. Syria has been bombing, gassing, and shooting its own people for 7 years. But having a forum to air offenses and name offenders furthers the cause of human rights, while a U.S. exit from such a forum does not. Long-term debate is essential to international cooperation, as we saw in the Obama administration's successful effort to clinch a multinational deal limiting Iran's nuclear program. President Trump, though, can't see the value in diplomacy, or, for that matter, in human rights. Surely it's no coincidence that the Trump administration pulled out of the council just as it embarked on a brutal family separation policy that almost certainly breaks international human rights laws, said the Observer in an editorial. It is a grotesque betrayal of Western values for the U.S. to treat desperate asylum seekers at the Mexican border as criminals, tear their children from their arms, and incarcerate toddlers in baby jails. President Trump is due to visit Britain on July 13th. If he won't change his nationalist, xenophobic policy, he should be turned back at the border. And this from France. Assimilation is hard on both sides. Even a tolerant and welcoming neighborhood can find it challenging to accept hundreds of migrants, said Anne Crignon. Sociologist Isabelle Couton said that firsthand in the summer of 2015, saw that firsthand in the summer of 2015, when more than 1 million desperate people entered Europe seeking asylum. The Paris government housed some 1,400 men, mostly Afghans, Sudanese, and Eritreans, mixed with some Iraqis and Chadians, in an empty high school building in the 19th arrondissement. In her book, Migrants at Home, Couton documented how, at first, locals exuded sympathy for their new neighbors who had suffered unimaginable distress and malnutrition on their journeys to Europe. Many residents told one another tales of their own ancestors from Armenia or Central Europe or Morocco who had fled horrors and found sanctuary in France. But soon the fear set in. The government, overwhelmed by the influx, had made no preparations to run the dormitory. There was a key turn and abandonment. Fights broke out among the men in that Tower of Babel, and when a projectile landed in a neighboring playground, parents began to demand the migrants be removed, saying they had to protect their kids. The men in their immaculately kept rooms, meanwhile, became disillusioned with their sanctuary. Why did they come here? The residents complain. Why, indeed, the migrants wonder. Here's one of the obituaries for you. The columnist who became a conservative icon. Charles Krauthammer, 1950 to 2018. Charles Krauthammer once described himself as a liberal mugged by reality. One of the most influential conservative columnists of the past 50 years, Krauthammer started his career in politics serving as a speechwriter for Democratic Vice President Walter Mondale. But his growing disenchantment with the welfare state, combined with his hawkish foreign policy views, led him to drift from the Democrats. As a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Washington Post and a frequent guest on Fox News, Krauthammer emerged as one of the most formidable thinkers of the American right. In the 1980s, he coined the term Reagan Doctrine to describe the president's support for anti-communist movements around the world and argued forcefully for the invasion of Iraq in the aftermath of 9/11. History is shaped by its battle of ideas, he said, and I wanted to be in the arena. Krauthammer was born in New York City to Jewish parents who fled Europe to escape the Holocaust, said the New York Times, a heritage that shaped his dim view of human nature. While studying to become a psychiatrist, he dove into a swimming pool and struck his head on the concrete bottom, snapping his spinal cord and leaving him mostly paralyzed from the neck down. He hated being defined by his disability. The worst thing is when people tell me how courageous I am, he says. That drives me to distraction. Krauthammer practiced psychiatry for a time before a restless curiosity led him to switch paths, said the Washington Post. Instead of diagnosing patients, he would analyze the body politic. In acerbic, unsparing prose, Krauthammer railed against the liberal monopoly of the media, defended the torture of suspected terrorists, and espoused the unflagging support for Israel. Krauthammer's views weren't always doctrinaire, said the Wall Street Journal. He broke with social conservatives on issues like abortion and stem cell research. Although a fierce critic of President Barack Obama, he denounced the Tea Party as extremist and opposed Donald Trump's candidacy, calling him a systemic stress test of American democracy. Diagnosed with cancer last year, he wrote a farewell note to readers in June, announcing that he had weeks to live. I leave this life with no regrets, he wrote, grateful to have played a small role in the conversations that have helped guide this extraordinary nation's destiny. And this is another of the best columns, but in the business section, titled E-Commerce, SCOTUS Ends Tax-Free Online Shipping. SCOTUS, of course, for the Supreme Court of the United States. You'll soon be paying more in taxes for online purchases, said Ben Fox Rubin in CNET.com. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 last week that states can force retailers beyond their borders to collect sales tax revenue from consumers, overturning a decades-old decision that only required companies to collect sales tax in states where they had a physical footprint. All this time, if retailers didn't collect sales tax, consumers in, for instance, New York, were ostensibly responsible for sending in the necessary taxes if they bought a product from a company in, say, Utah, something that most people never do. Brick-and-mortar retailers rejoiced at the South Dakota versus Wayfair ruling, saying the court had finally leveled the playing field, said Joyce Rosenberg in the Associated Press. But the change also angered many small online businesses, which say their expenses and compliance costs could now skyrocket because they will be responsible for sales tax in some 10,000 state and local jurisdictions nationwide. It's about time this bizarre loophole was finally closed, said Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com. In 1992, when SCOTUS first ruled on the issue, mail order sales totaled roughly $180 million. Last year, digital retailers sold $500 billion worth of goods. States have been losing out on an estimated $8 billion to $33 billion in uncollected revenue per year. Ensuring our tax system is a little less broken is a positive outcome for all of us, even if it means missing out on deals from time to time. However, this doesn't mean that websites will all of a sudden start collecting sales tax, said Elena Samuels in The Atlantic. So far, this ruling only covers South Dakota, which passed a law requiring retailers that sell $100,000 worth of goods in the state or process more than 200 separate sales to collect tax. It's still unclear what the implications are for other states or for the people who shop in them. 31 states currently have internet taxation laws, but their rules may be more restrictive than South Dakota's law, and so may not hold up in court. Lest you think Amazon is now in trouble, I expect CEO Jeff Bezos will lose zero sleep, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. The fact is that plenty of big players in online retail were already collecting sales tax on many, if not most, of their sales. That includes Amazon, which applies sales tax on all the items it sells directly to customers. It didn't always do so, and you can argue that its years-long tax dodge was key to its incredible growth. But as it has expanded, its vast network of fulfillment centers has made the company subject to state's tax jurisdiction. That's one reason this decision won't fundamentally change American shopping habits. But it did hand Amazon another opportunity to squash potential competitors, said James Freeman in the Wall Street Journal. The businesses most hurt by this ruling will be the millions of small business owners who sell on marketplaces like Amazon, eBay, and Etsy, who now have to navigate thousands of different tax rules. That's yet another advantage for Amazon, which could find a new opportunity in offering mom-and-pop online shops a tax collection service, for a fee, of course. Just one more way Washington is now helping the tech giant prevent upstarts from challenging its position. Well, and for a slight change of pace, we'll take the remaining minutes to read. It must be true. I read it in the tabloids. A New Jersey man looking to save time on his commute to New York City paddleboarded across the Hudson River last week while wearing a business suit and dress shoes. Aspiring comedian Russ Holt was running late for a meeting with a potential manager and decided the quickest way to get to Manhattan was straight across the mile-wide river. His 30-minute voyage wasn't smooth sailing. The wakes from passing ferries and boats nearly knocked him into the water several times. Holt said he forgot to wear a life jacket, so I would have been stuck out there drowning in a suit. That's the worst way to drown, dressed up. Zsa Zsa, an English bulldog with a pendulous tongue and a severe underbite, has been named the world's ugliest dog. The 9-year-old canine bested 13 other misshapen mutts to claim the title at the annual contest in Petaluma, California, which is meant to celebrate the animals, many of which were rescued from shelters, and promote pet adoption. Zsa Zsa's owner, Megan Brainerd, said the judges couldn't help but be charmed by her slobbering, big-hearted pet. "She is just so ugly," Brainerd said. "She's beautiful." A 24-year-old Englishman who constantly pestered his mom and dad for money has been banned from contacting them for 5 years. A court heard how Matthew Curley hassled his parents around the clock, once phoning them 30 times in a single day. Curley often lied about why he wanted the cash, once claiming that he had a job interview and needed to buy a new electric razor. His parents gave Curley the money, said a prosecutor, but soon after, he turned up at their house with a full beard. On the poll watch, 75% of Democrats consider reuniting their parents and children separated at the border a high priority, compared with 23% of Republicans and 41% of independents. 73% of Republicans think illegal immigrants should be punished as an example of toughness. And we'll finish with a quote from actress Helen Hayes. She says, "The hardest years in life are those between 10 and 70. With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.